I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 3rd of October. Our guest this hour is the author of Countdown. That's his latest book, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Alan Wiseman writes about how the world could heal and even refill if it were relieved of humanity's constant pressures. And get this for a statistic to remember this day. 1 million more of us, approximately every 4.5 days, 1 million more of us on a planet that's not getting any bigger. So Alan, who's also the author of World Without Us, an award-winning journalist, environmental journalist, whose reports have appeared in Harper's, New York Times, Atlantic, Discover, Mother Jones, and many others, decided to go all around the world and ask four really crucial questions, and it has to do with our very survival. And he writes about all of this in Countdown, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Alan. He's not quite with us yet, so we'll get him on the line here momentarily. Our phone number for you to join this as we look at populations in the world and what it is we need to do to have a sustainable planet. And it's not all gloom and doom. He does talk about certain countries where they've been able to bring the population down. How is population tied to people wanting to have enough people to not necessarily fight, but present a threat to those whose population numbers are not as great as theirs? What about contraception in the world? What about women and education? He writes about that extensively, that if women had education in places where they don't now, it could be the best thing in the whole world to reduce our numbers. The best contraceptive of all, he says, is educating women. A woman who gets through high school generally limits herself to 2 children or fewer because she has other things to do with her life rather than raising a dozen kids. So tapping female brain power would also exploit a priceless resource with no downside and would also help alleviate feared labor shortages as populations do shrink. How do we create an economy that can prosper without relying on constant growth? Those are some of the small issues. They're huge issues that we'll be talking about this hour with Alan. Our phone number again is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Alan. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Nice to have you here.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, I've read this a couple times, and I still can't believe it, that we have 1 million more people on this planet every 4.5 days? Are you kidding me?
No, I wish I were, but that is the situation, yes.
That is a huge number of people.
Well, you know, this is something that has kind of happened to us gradually. One of the many things that I mentioned in this book that is that back in 1968, Paul and Ann Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb, and it got a lot of attention and sold millions of copies because they were talking about the population explosion. Well, back then, there were just 3.5 billion people on the planet, and they were worried then. Well, today there's 7.2 billion on the planet. That's sort of what happens when things just keep growing.
Mm-hmm. You had four. I don't know if you'd like to outline briefly what each of those were, but you took four very big questions in writing this book. And this book was a heck of a lot of work, wasn't it? You went all over the world.
It certainly was. You know, when you pick up the book, it looks like a thick tome, but it's because the last 100 pages or so is bibliography. But along with all that literature search, I needed to go to ultimately 21 countries because I had to sort of take the cultural pulse of the planet to see what would be acceptable if we decided that we needed to gradually manage our numbers into a more sustainable level. And it all boiled down into those four questions you mentioned. I mean, the first one is simply, can we determine how many people can fit on this planet without tipping it over?
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the converse to that. How much nature do we need to preserve in order to guarantee our own survival? Is Is there something in the histories or the liturgies, the folklore, or the current circumstances of this broad swath of cultures that we have in this planet, and religions and political systems, nationalities, that might be able to accept that this is something that ought to be done, and it wouldn't violate their own belief system in order to, shall we say, refrain from embracing so much in times of need? And then the last one you just previewed, how would we design an economy that isn't based on continual growth, but that could still prosper? Because to have economic growth, you always need more people. You need more consumers on one end,
right,
and you need a bigger labor force.
Yeah, and we simply can't keep existing, as I think I'm sure you found that to be the answer when you talk to the top thinkers all over the world. We can't continue to grow and grow and grow. You can't do it forever.
Well, the problem is that the planet doesn't grow.
Right.
And, we as one species are sort of overwhelming all the other species. We're pushing a lot of things off the planet that at some point, we might push something off the planet that we wish we hadn't, and we won't know until it's too late that, oops, we should have kept that one.
I thought it was interesting that you took on the religious question here. I really had no idea that the largest fertility rate in this country is among Mormons. It's in Utah. And you go to Jerusalem and you're talking with people who are of a certain religious faith who really believe that you have to build the numbers in that faith because other faiths may be out to get them. And so you want to have more people if you have to even physically fight, or not even physically, but they know that they can be intimidated because you've got greater numbers. Isn't it interesting that's still happening? And I'm wondering how widely is that happening?
I think it's universal. I think that every culture starts out with some variation on be fruitful and multiply because they want to build themselves into a dominant force on the landscape that they inhabit in order to keep inhabiting it so they don't get outcompeted by some bigger force out there. So the Mormons, being a rather new culture, they go back to the 19th century. Well, they were polygamists because they were popping out as many babies as they could to build themselves a mighty nation. But that's no different from the rest of us. You go back to Genesis, or you read by the time of the patriarchs, the Israelites are all polygamists. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob,
right.
They're having multiple wives and they're having multiple kids. But then something fascinating happens. Jacob's son Joseph, who is one of 13 kids, was very observant. Sometimes I think he may have been our first ecologist that we know of in recorded history, because he realized that we were approaching a time of scarcity. And he ends up having only one wife and only two children, and he counsels the Pharaoh of Egypt that in order to survive, this is a time of conserving. And a Talmudic scholar who I talked to in Tel Aviv explained to me the Talmudic teachings on this, is that in a time of famine, you don't have children. This is something that was understood back then, and it saved the day for both the Egyptians and the Israelites.
So is there, when you talk to people, let's go to Palestine for a moment. One of the questions you ask is there an acceptable nonviolent way to convince people of all cultures, religions, nationalities, tribes, political systems, that it's in their best interest to have the human population avoid going past 10 billion people? So you're talking about Yasser Arafat, somebody you're talking to, can't remember who it is, Yasser Arafat's biology bomb that is taught in the mosque, it's taught in school, it's taught in home to have lots of children for a lot of reasons. When you met with this Palestinian demographer, what was his response to all that you presented? Is there an acceptable way? Were these questions even entertained?
Well, what he told me is that, he grew up at a time when Yasser Arafat was head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and he well remembered those talks in, the Friday sermons in the mosques about, have lots of babies. Arafat used to say that the Palestinian womb was the best weapon that they had in their arsenal. But he told me that things are changing now, and many Palestinian women I talked to explained that they were changing for them, because because, look, they are living in crowded conditions. Their territory has become smaller and smaller as more settlements have been built. And the only way that they can get ahead is by giving their kids a good education. So when you're living in a small space and you want to be able to afford to educate your children, you don't want to have a lot of kids. It's impossible. I have a scene in there in a refugee camp in Ramallah. It's been a refugee camp for about half a century now. And all these people come out of large families, but all the young women now are saying, I only want two at most, because how are we going to afford it? And where's everybody right. going to sleep?
Right. Let's go to Niger. With the world's highest fertility rate, each woman bears an average of 7 to 8 children. Why?
Because this is a West African nation in the Sahel. It's very, very poor. Nutrition is very poor. And women keep having babies to try to stay one step ahead of the Grim Reaper that takes so many of their babies. They die of malnutrition. In village after village that I went to, 100, 150, 200 kids would have died in the previous year. And the climate's changing on them. They all talked about the 10-year drought cycle that then became a 5-year drought cycle and then a 3-year drought cycle. And they're still in the one that started 3 years ago. It's a very, very sad story.
Mm. So if these women, you also talk about probably the most important contraceptive in the world right now would be allowing women in Niger and other places to have education.
Even in that country and in some very difficult countries, I went to like Pakistan, whenever you get girls into school, if you can get them through high school, the chances are that they're going to have two children or fewer, because they're going to end up with something interesting and important, but also very helpful for their family to do. They want to be mothers and raise children, but you can't do this with 7 kids hanging on your apron strings. But you can with 2. So I've got numerous examples in the book. You mentioned religion before, and I want to backtrack just for 1 second to explain about that. When we think about population control, which is kind of an explosive term, everybody thinks of the Chinese one-child policy. Mm-hmm. And to most people, it's abhorrent. I spent a month in China for this book, and a lot of Chinese feel the same way too, though they recognize that, there'd be 400 million more of us if we hadn't have done this. Whether they have to keep doing it now that it's become part of their culture, that's an open question there. But the fact is, most of us don't want the government telling us what to do in our bedrooms. They don't want, women don't want some law governing their reproductive decisions. So I needed to poll so many of the world's religions and belief systems to see what would be acceptable to them. And fortunately, I found several great examples, nation-size examples, of countries that have been able to bring their population growth rate down to manageable terms, and they've done it completely voluntarily.
And one of them, surprisingly, is Iran.
Yeah, and that's an example, like Niger and Pakistan, of Muslim countries. And when you go to Western Europe, which is another place I went, a lot of people are so frightened. There's this xenophobic wave that traditional Europe is going to be overwhelmed by these immigrants who are right. having so many babies, and Europe's going to be one big Muslim country with mosques from end to end by the middle of this century. But it turns out that the Muslim immigrants, the young women who, once they get into a school system in, say, Italy or the UK, 2 places that I went, they also want to have just 2 children. And countries like Tunisia have brought their population growth rate down to replacement, meaning 2 people have 2 kids to replace them. And Iran actually did it. It's an amazing story, because at one point they had the highest growth rate on the planet. They had forced that growth rate because right after the revolution, Saddam Hussein invaded them. He wanted this oil-rich province on their border, just like he invaded Kuwait about a decade later. And the Ayatollah asked every fertile woman to get pregnant to produce this 20 million man army to be able to, to fight off the invaders. Well, 8 years later, the war finally ended in a truce, and Iran realized that it had this generation that within 10, 15 years was going to need employment, and their economy would nowhere near be mature enough to do that. So they feared having this big surplus of underemployed or unemployed, frustrated young men. By the way, that kind of defines Pakistan today.
Mm-hmm.
So they started a program that was totally acceptable to them under the Quran. The Ayatollah, it's actually the current Ayatollah, issued a fatwa saying that there's nothing in the Quran that dictates, that says if wisdom dictates you have the number of children you want, that you can't partake of, in fact, he used the word vasectomy. And as a result of that, everything from condoms up to vasectomies and tubal ligations were suddenly made available to everyone in the country for free. And there were banners that said, you know, one is enough, two is good, or vice versa. And the only thing that was compulsory was young couples, before they got married, had to go to premarital counseling. It could be in the mosque or in a health service. And there they would learn exactly what it costs to raise and feed and educate a child. And they started getting the message. I mean, they figured it out. They also, and this is critical again, they encouraged women to study because a woman will defer her childbearing. So today, 60% of Iranian university students are female, and they brought themselves down to replacement rate a year faster than China.
Remarkable. What about the Roman Catholic Church, which has had, it seems to me, all kinds of problems in deciding what it's going to do when it comes to birth control and issues of population? A lot of people are Roman Catholic in this world. How is having one child or being able to use birth control, do any people in the Catholic Church, any very powerful people in the Catholic Church espouse that now?
Well, there's two ways to think about the Catholic Church. You can think about the Catholic hierarchy, meaning the Vatican and all the bishops, or you can think about the Catholic people. We all know that the hierarchy has been against birth control. And the reason for that is that they've kind of painted themselves into a corner. Back in the middle of the 19th century, you know, the Vatican used to be a middle-sized country in Europe, but they lost all their territory in a popular uprising, and then they came down to what it is today, this 110 acres called Vatican City, populated by 1,000 people, nearly all of them male. And having lost their power, the Pope then came up with another way to hold on to or to make people believe that what they said still counted and that they were really a power that to be reckoned with, and that was papal infallibility. Mm-hmm. The word of God is coming through the mouth of the Pope. So later on, when contraception started coming around, for reasons I explain in the book, they declared it to be against the will of God. And of course, the reason was that the Catholic Church really needed all the bodies it could get to remain powerful, whether they were recruiting them locally or in far-flung regions. So then you get into the middle 60s, and suddenly there's Vatican II, and papal commissions are saying that contraception should be legalized under canon law. And, you know, even after that, I go to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences in the Vatican, who issued a report about 20 years ago saying that it's now unconscionable to advise people to have more than 2.3 kids per family because it's just simply so unsustainable on this mm-hmm. planet. And yet, if they were to change their mind, then they're stuck with saying, well, the popes for the last century were wrong and those Protestant ministers were right. So they can't change. However, surrounding the Vatican is this country called Italy. It's a Catholic country, and it has one of the lowest fertility rates on the planet because Italian women are so well educated and so many of them work. And, you know, here in the United States, 98% of Catholic women have either used or are currently using contraception. So I think this is one of those cases where, unfortunately, the church is going to have great difficulty in publicly changing on this. But in the meantime, people take it into their own hands. And, you know, there's a social dilemma there, I guess, but we all have contradictions in our lives.
Right.
And I guess Catholics are working it out. Yeah.
We'll take phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Alan Wiseman. He's the author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for Future on Earth. This is a sequel, really, to The World Without Us, which was a bestseller all over the world. And this one asked four major questions of people and big thinkers in 20 countries all over the world. He went to all places that are bursting, like Pakistan and India, and places that have done some fairly remarkable things to keep population under control, Japan, Iran, other places. So we're looking at a number of questions: how much ecosystem is required to maintain life, how many people can live on this planet, how many people can the land really hold? Is there an acceptable nonviolent way to convince people all over the world, all these different cultures and religions and political systems, that it's in the best interest of their countries and also of this planet to have the human population avoid growing past $10 billion people, or even to reduce our numbers from the 7 billion already here? To your phone calls momentarily. A couple lines are open, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Alan Wiseman. His latest book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And we start our calls with Mike in Dodgeville. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Yeah. First, let me say I really enjoyed your first book, The World Without Us, and have recommended it to several friends. My question is what's your feelings about the earlier work done by the MIT scientists called Limits to Growth? And, you know, that was written 30 years ago. And in their 30-year revision, they've outlined 10 steps to get Earth back to carrying capacity. I'd be curious about your feelings on that.
Well, Limits to Growth is something that I mentioned in my book. They were very prescient, and they explained that there was going to be a point when all the curves were going to start intersecting. The number of human beings going up, the number of resources going down, and something was going to have to give. And we would have to think about living within our limits. I have not read their whole 10 points towards sustainability, so I can't really comment on them. But I can comment on the fact that once Limits to Growth came out and people started really, for the first time, thinking that, wow, are we entering scarcity? There was sort of a backlash, the idea being, I think, in some people's minds that, wow, if resources are going to get scarce, let's go get them while the getting is good. And suddenly we saw this amazing splurge that turned into the great global marketplace. And in all these products were available. We lived in the cornucopia. You could get blueberries year-round and melons. And it just tended to give a lot of people a sense that there really isn't a problem. There isn't scarcity. And something else that happened, you know, Malthus predicted back when there were fewer than a billion people that someday population was going to outstrip food production. And then Paul and Ann Ehrlich and the population bomb said that it was imminent for the 1970s. But then it didn't happen because this Green Revolution took place that produced all these crops that could grow much more food per stalk of wheat or rice. And that saved the day. There was no famine in Egypt, in India and Pakistan, where the Green Revolution was first tried out. But what everybody forgets is that Ehrlich and Malthus were not really refuted, as so many economists who don't think there are limits to growth claim. In fact, the founder of the Green Revolution, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for being credited for saving more people than any human in history, in his acceptance speech, he didn't gloat about that. He said that he basically bought the world a generation of time. Unless the forces for population control were collaborated hand in hand with the forces for increased food production, all was going to be lost, because the more food you produce, the more people survive to give birth to more people, and the more food you constantly need. And at a certain point, all our technological tricks just aren't going to be able to keep up.
Thank you, Mike, very much for the call. I want to spend a little bit of time, when you look at question number four, the sustainable population and designing the economy for a shrinking population and then for a stable one. Let's look at the West for a moment. Let's look at America for a moment, and imagining, if anybody knows the answer to this, what kind of lives we have to live, what kind of economy could prosper without our, and we're running into this all the time now with the debt ceiling lifting and how much money we spend on programs, et cetera, without constantly growing, without buying more and more new houses, new cars, new everything. It seems as though it requires a radically different vision of life, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Nearly every economic system, and not just capitalism, you know, has always talked about growth as being the measure of the health of an economy. And yet that works as long as there are no limitations. When we were a much smaller species and we had room to grow and there were more resources to discover, you know, I was doing pretty fine. But now, for example, let's look at our energy. We're now getting it in the riskiest of places. We're fracturing the bedrock here under North America, or mining the very dirty tar sands. And in Japan, where I went to look at exactly your question for this book, they have based their economy on a lot of nuclear power, and all their plants are in very risky places.
No.
They're in seismic zones, or they're exposed on the coastline where tsunamis can hit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Japan is one of the first countries, and certainly the first developed country, that is really looking at population shrinkage now. And it wasn't because they planned it that way. After World War II, they had a baby boom for the same reasons that we did. The soldiers came home, but they had lost the war. Their economy was shredded, and they couldn't afford all these new babies. And suddenly, they had an emergency on their hand, a mass starvation. So to meet that emergency, this was in the days before birth control, they legalized abortion, and many, many Japanese women partook of that because they didn't want to watch another baby die of hunger. So they cut off their baby boom, and now, as the previous generation, which is one of those older big generations, some of you may remember that Japan got into that war because they wanted to expand their population. The islands weren't big enough for it, so they wanted to expand into Manchuria. Today, they're looking at a much smaller population that is going to take the place of this big generation that's dying off. And they are being forced to adjust accordingly, because it will keep dropping, and by the middle of the century, it's going to be back to what it was at the end of World War II. Now, I met a Japanese economist. He's not some radical. He's with a very important National Policy Institute. Akihiko Matsutani, who sees an opportunity here. Over the next couple of generations, gradually they'll be able to adjust. So many people won't have to crowd into these expensive port cities where there's a lot of heavy industry, though they're already starting to spread back over the land, because as all this, you know, this older farming generation dies off, land and even housing is a lot cheaper out there. Lighter industries that produce mainly just in consumer goods, not heavy export things, will be able to follow them, because workers will become more valuable. There'll be fewer of them, so wages won't drop, but because demand will eventually be lower, hours can drop. And that means one of the ways to redefine prosperity is by having more leisure time. Today in Japan, you know, a worker goes, leaves the house at 7 o'clock, gets home at 10, and, you know, so he can afford some consumer toys that he can play with.
10 at night?
Oh, that's pretty common in Tokyo.
Whoa.
And, you know, he has barely any hours to enjoy that huge television set or whatever, you know, whatever other little appliances that he's bought for entertainment. But for fewer, you know, when there are fewer hours, the idea of pleasure is not necessarily going to be going to Disneyland. It could be going outdoors, because there will be more breathing space outdoors, as gradually there will be fewer people. And this is a transition from a total growth economy to a steady state economy that could be very palatable if we implement it over a period of decades, which is the best way to do it. You know, if we all went to the one-child policy, which we're not going to do, by the end of this century, we'd be back to 1.6 billion, which is what it was in 1900, before our population doubled and then doubled again, because our medical technology and our food production technology suddenly became so adept. But if everybody knows that they can have two children, replacement rate, or fewer if they want fewer, or if you really want more, there's this pretty not exhausted resource out there called homeless children. You know, adoption is always an option. And a little more gradually, we can bring our population down to sustainable level and do it in such a way that it's not so wrenching economically.
Right. Kenneth, our next caller in Janesville. Hi.
Hello. I was very disappointed to hear what your guest had to say about the Catholic Church. I mean, there were statements made that are totally ignorant of what the church's stand is on spacing births, and we've used the word birth control to mean using means of spacing your children, which are contrary to the laws of God. The church is against that, but is not against spacing the children according to the laws of God. And everything you said, you know, are prejudicial statements that have been made for the last 500 years.
I don't really think they're prejudicial. It's...
But you know, Kathleen, Kenneth is right. The church does counsel birth spacing. I met with a cardinal of the church. He's the head of the Council for Peace and Justice, which is also the one that speaks to environmental issues in the Vatican. And he explained to me that he was the first bishop actually to take a class in what is called the Billings Method, which is a natural way of spacing
right.
Spacing your births. It's basically a variation of the rhythm method.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unfortunately, the rhythm method is just not a very useful, predictable way of being able to absolutely determine when it's not safe to have sex, simply for the reason that sperm will remain live in a woman's body up to 6 days. So, yes, you know, he explained to me, frankly, in very graphic terms. It was interesting hearing a Catholic cardinal talk about this, about vaginal fluids and how you could tell the difference. But But it's elementary that that the change in consistency, shall we say, doesn't necessarily conveniently match the lifespan of sperm inside a woman's body. So, you know, I appreciate the Catholic Church's efforts to try to be understanding about a woman's needs here, but frankly, the overwhelming number of Catholic women out there aren't buying it.
Yeah, they think it's unrealistic. Exactly. Yeah. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Thanks, Kenneth, for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Alan Wiseman is our guest. We're talking about his latest book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. It's his long-awaited follow-up book. He's with us this hour to talk about this book. The follow-up book is titled, I want to make sure I get this, In the World Without Us, which was an international bestseller. He's going to be in Madison tomorrow at a book event at Westtown Mall, Barnes & Noble at 7 o'clock, in case you would like to talk to him. He's a professor of journalism, has been, and Latin American studies at the University of Arizona, where he led, wouldn't this be fun, an annual field program in international field journalism. He's also taught writing and journalism at Prescott College, Williams College, has been a Fulbright scholar in Columbia. And this particular book took him all over the world, where he asked four of the most pressing questions, if not the pressing questions of our time. So back to you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two phone calls again. Dan in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, Kathleen. Good show. Great guest. I was wondering if what your guest take on would be on the existence of nature. Does it still exist? And also, being in the paradoxical situation that we call life, our children are the future, but they are also the largest investment in the status quo. And if you're a person of low means like myself, if you want to have time, the best thing you can do to have time and to think would be not to reproduce. So anyway, I was wondering if your guest would just comment on those ideas.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. Does nature still exist? Yes, it does exist, but it's a different kind of nature than maybe has ever existed before, because, you know, Bill McKibben pointed out in a book called The End of Nature, everything is different now because we've changed the atmosphere by our own actions, so everything now is touched by one species, being ourselves. And as we've spread more and more across the land, and as we use, you know, 40% of the non-frozen terrestrial planet to feed ourselves, you know, either through cultivation or through grazing, we are by far the dominant force on the planet. I spent a lot of time with environmental scientists, with ecologists in many different countries, starting in Israel and ending in Iran, looking at how we can coexist with nature. One of the most interesting trips that I took, actually two of them, because I was accompanying Gretchen Daly, who's the head of conservation biology at Stanford, and by the way, a protege of Paul and Ann Ehrlich, the ones who wrote The Population Bomb. Her goal in life and of her colleagues, who she works with in every country, is to get people to value the capital of nature so we don't extinguish it, because that ultimately will extinguish, you know, the very stuff that gives us all the life and the resources that we have. I went with her to Latin America and to China, and in Costa Rica, an experiment that she and her colleagues have had running for a long time show that the agricultural fields that do the best are the ones that are closest to rainforest, because they get from birds and bees and bats and reptiles pollination and predator control help. In China, we saw the same thing. And China, of course, because of its huge population growth before it instituted its policy, lost so many of its forests. They're now spending $40 billion to put those forests back. Every place that you have got a nature and a human managed landscape so we can grow food, coexisting with each other, you know, ribbons of forest in between fields, our agricultural output is better. So nature does better and we do better if we can kind of divide up this planet a little more. And that may be what the future looks like. A lot of species are lost, but a surprising number of them are hanging on in those patches of forest. And if, particularly if we start using fewer chemicals to force feed our planet to grow even more food for more of us, then we have a better chance of coming to a working truce with the rest of nature.
And we have to be darn careful, as you remind us, of letting many of those species go, because who knows which one is going to be so important that it upsets everything.
Absolutely. You know, there's just no way to know. You know, the Ehrlichs have this famous story called the Rivet Poppers.
Oh, yes.
You're getting on an airplane and you notice some guy who's popping the rivets out of the wing. And you ask him, what are you doing? He says, because, you know, there's so many rivets here. There's a lot of extras and we can sell these things, use them again. And, you know, so far, no problem. The wing hasn't fallen off. Well, at what point will that wing fall off of this spaceship that we are flying called Earth? I would hate to gamble with that any more than we already are by trying to find out.
Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Hello.
Hello. Thank you. You've alluded to this a number of times, and I'd like to see if you can be a little more specific. The sustainability of the ecosystem is, as you described, in direct conflict with sustainability of the economy, of our economy, which requires constant growth and expansion of population, goods, of all production and consumption. Do you have some idea of what an economy, how an economy could be designed that would match a sustainable natural system?
That's a good question.
Yeah, well, a couple of people in my book speak to that. But let me preface their words by explaining that the economy as we know it right now is based on energy. Once we really learn how to tap concentrated energy with fossil fuels particularly, suddenly we could do much more than nature could do, in a sense. You know, we literally have gotten to jet propel us ourselves. But it's been exciting and we've got all this neat stuff. Unfortunately, the exhaust from this is now starting to become a force that is putting a real damper on what we're going to do. Our changes to the atmosphere and our changes to the seas as a result, the seas are warming, rising, and they're acidifying, are really throwing a lot of the future of our economy into doubt. So one of the first steps, of course, is taking into account those aspects of nature that either contribute to our economy, like valuable resources, I mentioned pollinators before, or they are places where we throw the waste products away that are starting to fill up and overflow in very nasty ways. And we have to learn how to recycle all that stuff on a much better level than we're already doing if we don't want to damage the system that underlies our entire economy. Now, there's some more radical ideas. In fact, one of them isn't radical at all. It's really quite conservative. And that is to change the way that we create money. Stop letting banks create it, because, you know, every time you write a check, bank only has to hold 20% of that money that the check is based on. They can loan out the rest. So it's basically creating five times the amount of money, and that just keeps expanding and expanding, and our impression of what is going on keeps expanding, though, of course, then it periodically collapses like it did in the housing debacle a couple of years ago. If governments just created the money to build, you know, whatever we need to keep society going, and then you know, once it was done, then that money just came back into the coffers and stayed there, things would be an awful lot simpler, and we would be talking in terms of real money, not in terms of imaginary money, which has been a great deal of fun, but it's gotten us into an awful lot of trouble. And this is actually an idea that can really appeal to conservatives, because in a shrinking population where you have to be dealing with real amounts of money, not expanding amounts of money, the only way to be able to do it would be by balancing the budget. We couldn't be using deficit spending, because that would involve imaginary money, money that we would essentially borrow into existence. So, you know, a whole lot of people on all sides of the spectrum have been making a lot of sense. And if you pull it all together, there is a way that we can do it.
Thanks, Kurt, for your call. Let's go to Darren next in Ashland. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I just wanted to comment. So a few, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I saw the movie Idiocracy. I think it was based off of a novel as well, and really a silly and crude movie. But the premise of the movie was that the undereducated would reproduce at a much higher rate, much, you know, far above the replacement rate, and then the educated would wait to have children and reproduce at or below the replacement rate. And over a long period of time, the undereducated really overwhelmed the educated population. I guess I'd just like to hear your comments on that, especially as we underfund education as it is in our society, in America. I'll hang up and I'll let you respond.
Darren.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks, Darren. You know, I didn't see that movie, but in a crude sense, possibly even a very elitist sense, there's a lot of wisdom in that, which the converse of it is what I have really learned in the research for this book is so critical. The way to bring our world back into balance the fastest is to educate people, particularly educating women. I mean, it's a wasted resource in so much of the world. All these fine female minds that just given a chance. I mean, even in places like, you know, difficult places like Pakistan, I found, you know, pockets where schools were making sure that there was a 50-50 balance between girls and boys, so they would grow up learning to respect each other. And so girls would see these role models, first in their teachers and then with the mentors that the schools were setting them up with. You know, some of them were doctors, nurses, flight attendants, all these really interesting professional females who incidentally were having fewer kids so they could do those jobs. And people will get the message. You know, we've now got information technology that can spread learning so far, and so much learning. And if we take advantage of this opportunity that we have, we will end up coming down to a much more sustainable figure. You know, even though I've written about renewable energy a lot, and I really believe that we have to be developing as much as we can, it's not going to do anything for us overnight, because it's not widespread enough to be able to run all of our cities and our factories and our Indias and our Chinas. And you also have to expend a lot of carbon dioxide just to mine the materials for and to build, wind and solar systems. But this is something that we've already got the technology for. We know how to do contraception. And my book shows some of the really effective and simple male contraceptives that are coming on very soon. So it's going to allow us to sort of share the burden amongst the two genders. It seems to me that while we're waiting in vain for completely zero emission energy to occur, the fastest way that we can have a positive impact on our environmental impact is to bring down the number of impactors, the number of carbon emitters, by gradually bringing our population down over the next couple of generations to a really reasonable level, so that this world can continue to hold us.
Thanks very much for all of your calls. And Alan Wiseman, thank you so much for such a thoughtful and really provocative and important conversation. Thanks.
Well, thank you. I look forward to being in Madison tomorrow.
Great. And he will be in Madison tomorrow at a book event. It's at Westtown Mall, Barnes & Noble, 7 o'clock tomorrow night, to talk about his latest book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. You travel all over the world asking these four very important questions. And he is quite a writer. He's written for all kinds of important publications, and he has taught, laureate professor in journalism and Latin American studies at the University of Arizona. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program, and thanks for listening and calling in to this program. A reminder that we will be with you again on Monday, all things political. Who knows what will happen politically in the next few days, but we'll want to talk about it Monday at 1 o'clock, one of our regularly scheduled hours. Thanks, everybody. News and great conversation ahead.